Welcome to the Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. It is our second episode of the week. Bruce, spring football starting to wind down. We've got a whole bunch of spring games this Saturday. And let's kind of put a bow on our respective travels throughout the month. You had a story go up on Thursday from your visit to Texas. And we mentioned this on the last podcast with Andy Staples about the Texas lockers. But there's more to say.
Yeah, so I talked to Tom Herman about the lockers. You know, we talked about first when I visited with him on Friday, you know, dealing with entitlement. And that was one of the knocks that has been plaguing the Texas program for much of the past decade, certainly in the last few years. That's one of the issues Charlie Strong was trying to work against and obviously wasn't able to get turned around fast enough. But so we talked about that and what he's doing. But then, you know, we talked more this week after I left, just because I had to finish up the interview, on the reaction he got and Texas got on social media. And I said, you know, was this exactly, what did you make of it? And he was very blunt. He was like, the only reaction I care about is that of our players and our recruits. I don't care about Twitter's reaction. I don't care about social media's reaction. Our players loved it. The recruits loved it, and mission accomplished on that. And it was, you know, when I asked some of his players, and these are older players, one of them, Puna Ford, who's a defensive lineman there, he's a senior, I had said, you know, because he was like, man, if I'm a recruit, I'm thinking, dang, that's catching my eye and everything. I said, but what do you really think it could make the difference in one recruit picking Texas over Oklahoma or Texas over A&M? And he said, yes, I do, because everything matters. And, you know, you follow that up with, you know, because I went right to Tom with, you know what, some of the reaction you got from people to this, and maybe he didn't see a lot of it, but I definitely did, was this is an example of the entitlement issue. And, it, you know, is there a disconnect here between, you know, you're bringing these kids, luring them with these, you know, extravagant and, you know, as one other, you know, rival coach put it, this stuff is absurd, you know, stuff. And, you know, do people scratch their heads on why you're going to have a team that would be entitled or that issue? And he was very blunt. He was like, first of all, I don't care. And second of all, I'd rather have us be soft with really good players than soft with really bad players. And by the way, we're not going to be soft. And he kind of talked about the stuff that, you know, they had done at Houston. And he said that was definitely not a soft team. And he said you need good players. And the finest facilities in the country attract really good players. And soft isn't anything about what they get or the gear they get. And he said, if you're soft, it's because your culture is soft. What do you think, what do you make of his comments and his position on this?
Well, I don't doubt that the players and the recruits love it. You know, you always run the risk the older you get of being in the stay, you know, get off my lawn crowd. I mean, I remember when Oregon first unleashed what we know now as the Oregon uniforms, and this would have been like early 2000s. I mean, those were controversial. You know, now it's just like an accepted part of college football that these schools all have cool alternate uniforms. But when Oregon first did it, it was just seen as like blasphemy. Like, how could you, you know, college football uniforms had a certain look. And these were, I think people referred to them as the Flintstone uniforms back then. And people were very dismissive of it. And Oregon would say, but the recruits love it. And you know what? They do. So I don't doubt that the players and the recruits love it. The part of your story that struck me a little bit, or his comments, is when he's kind of talking about the detail that went into it. He's like, as he worked on the, you know, he apparently also did put a lot into the locker room at Houston. I've learned a lot about lockers. We just redone the locker room in Houston 1 year ago. Obviously, we didn't have solid surface doors there. We learned a little bit about what A&M had and what Penn State had and what Oregon had. I knew that was the cleanest, sleekest, sturdiest way to go, was a solid surface door. Now, all college football coaches sweat the details, but the fact that Tom Herman spends this much mental energy on what kind of doors they're going to have on the lockers, I'm sorry, but I don't know how that's going to help you beat Oklahoma.
Well, the reason why they think it might help beat Oklahoma is because if A&M spent $8,000 on lockers, we're going to spend, you know, $10,500 on it. And they have white doors. We got to have something, as you said, it different and something better. You know, we talked about this. We had a mailbag question. I think it was a couple of weeks ago. You answered it, and you were skeptical that this kind of stuff would be the difference in getting a recruit or not. And I mean, I think it's a reality of life in 2017 that this stuff does matter to them.
Well, I think there's an expectation that you have good facilities, right? If these kids, if you're an elite recruit and you're going on official visits to Alabama, Texas, you know, Oregon, you name it, there's an expectation they're going to have really cool facilities, right? If you walked into one of these places and it was run down and there was carpet peeling, you'd be really turned off, and that would be a reason probably to exclude that school. But in terms of why you're going to pick Texas over A&M or Texas over Oklahoma, no, I don't buy that that's the reason. They're all nice facilities. You're picking it because of the coach, because of the way you get along with the players, the system they run, their ability to send you to the NFL, and the facilities. It's like, well, it's good to know. It's good to know that I'm going to be treated well here, for sure. But I just really seriously doubt it's like, if it happens, you know, bring it to me and I'll fall on the sword. If there is a commitment in this coming class where the guy says, where they say, why'd you pick Texas? And he says, because of those really cool lockers, then so be it. But I don't buy it.
I think you're giving the 18 and 17 and 16 year olds a little too much credit. You're thinking like an adult. And sometimes there are guys who I think would have picked places over what kind of jersey number they get to wear and what they don't get to wear at another place.
Or a girl they met on their official visit.
Who may never see them again.
Yeah, no, I know. I know that that's possible. But we're talking like this being the difference maker.
Well, again, I go back to the Puna Ford comment, everything matters. And I think if this is something that gets them thinking, leaning in a direction where all of a sudden now, you know, Tom Herman or somebody on his staff is able to make a stronger case for them to go to convince them, then it is a difference. I mean, it's maybe not the ultimate deciding thing, but if it's one aspect that kind of enticed them to get them on board or get them excited about the place, I don't know. I just think, like, especially after doing that recruiting book 10 years ago, my expectation and my perspective on it is nothing would surprise me when you're dealing with, you know, 16 and 17 year olds who are really in kind of a whirlwind with all these coaches and fans recording them and wooing them.
Well, speaking of super duper facilities, since the last time we talked on here, I visited Oregon.
So this was your first, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time you actually ever met Willie Taggart, correct?
It is. Yeah, it was the first time I met Willie Taggart. But I was just going to say, I'm sure people have heard about it or maybe seen the pictures, but I can't emphasize enough. And this is my third or fourth time in this building, but their Death Star football facility is unlike anything else you'll see out there. You can see it. It's so pronounced that, you know, oftentimes when you go visit these schools, right, you have to ask the SID, you know, how do I get to the facility? You don't have to do that at Oregon. Drive to the football stadium and you will see this enormous black, like, futuristic looking building from miles away. Yeah, it was my first time meeting Willie Taggart. We sat down, we had a great conversation. He's pretty blunt about the personnel he inherited, or shall we say the lack of personnel that he inherited. Not necessarily on the offensive side of the ball, where you've got, first of all, you got Royce Freeman. I think people might forget at this point that he's still there. I mean, this is a guy who was a star freshman running back when they went to the national championship game. Mm-hmm. He's still there. Justin Herbert was a very promising, coming off a very promising freshman season at quarterback. But, you know, they were one of the worst, if not the worst, defenses in the country last year. And his comment to me was, you know, when they got out on the practice field, he's like, I couldn't believe how weak we are. You know, this is a Power 5 school. And I mean, basically saying, like, you know, the players he had at USF were stronger, physically stronger, than the guys who were lining up out there on defense for Oregon, and they're lacking for talent. Scott Pagano, the Clemson grad transfer, is definitely going to help them. But he's pretty blunt about it. Like, we need to go recruit. We need to go build this up. And I'm still just puzzled at how this could have happened so quickly. Because, I mean, you look back since we've been covering this sport, you know, Miami peaked around 2001, 2002, and then it started to gradually decline. You could say that about any number of programs that had long success. But in Oregon's case, two years and 3 months ago, they were playing in the national championship game. And here we are, 2 years and 3 months later, talking about a program that is in need of a complete rebuilding job. How does that happen so quickly?
Well, a couple of things. I think one factor that maybe we're not giving enough credit to them, you know, playing for the national title, is they had an all-time great player who I think, I don't want to say inflated it, because they still had good skill talent around him, but Marcus Mariota, you know, if Marcus Mariota's not there, and they may be an 8-4 team, you know? But I think when you look back, and this is why I was curious to do this, and this isn't probably the greatest way to gauge talent, but if you go back to the 2014 draft, they have had 6 players taken in the top 3 rounds, which is pretty good. And I think so. They do have some top-level talent, but I think, you know, because you look at it, DeForest Buckner, when he was there, I mean, they were a bad defense when DeForest Buckner was there in 2015. And DeForest Buckner was the best defensive player in the Pac-12. So you take him away, there's a pretty good chance they're going to be worse, right? And I just look at it, you know, they had Eric Armstead before that, who was a first-round pick. You know, they've had talent in places, but I just think it was the depth of it was pretty lacking.
I don't think people realized at the time, Nick Aliotti is not somebody who ever got the praise and the reputation of like Pat Narduzzi or Dave Aranda. Yeah, he was never the hot defensive coordinator. He was a guy that did this for decades, and his defenses, even when they were winning a lot of games, were giving up a lot of yards because of that system they ran in. But they were pretty good defenses. And so he retires after the 2013 season. Don Pelham takes over. That was a mistake. Brady Hoke coming in, that didn't help. But, you know, more than scheme and whether they're going to run a 4-3 or a 3-4, for whatever reason, they just started missing on defensive recruits. Not recruits turning them down, just poor evaluation, because now you're left with nothing. So they've got to rebuild that up. I don't think it's going to be a quick fix. If you look at the trajectory of what he did at USF, he took over a program that was also coming off, Skip Holtz didn't have a great time. They weren't terrible, but they didn't have great teams. And they went and they took a dip at first, and people started to panic. I mean, a few games into his third season, people thought he was going to get fired.
Not just almost everybody there thought he was going to get fired. To me, the biggest credit to Willie Taggart was he did something that very few coaches are able to do. And that's when everybody else thinks you're about to get fired. He like flipped a switch. They had lost a game, but they were competitive in it. And all of a sudden they went on this, you know, amazing run for basically the next season and a half. And to the point where he left it, where a lot of people think Charlie Strong inherited a team that, I don't know if they can make the playoff, but should be a top 15, top 20 team. So I think that's a credit to Willie Taggart. I mean, he's a Jim Harbaugh guy. A lot of times he feels like he's the third Harbaugh brother. Harbaugh was his best man. And I think there is a belief inside him that, hey, this is, you know, I'm going to make this work. And I think one thing that's very interesting is, you know, I don't know if you use the word soft when you describe that team, but a lot of people have talked about him being finesse and everything about that program. 3 of the guys he hired on that staff, Jim Leavitt, who did a fantastic job with the Colorado defense, Mario Cristobal, who's his offensive coordinator, and then the other one was Joe Salavea, who did a really good job in the Pac-12. He most recently was Washington State's defensive line coach, and I'm sure he had a big role and Scott Pagano deciding to transfer there as opposed to Oklahoma or Notre Dame. Those are guys that I think, you know, will be a big impact in terms of the temperament, not just the kind of kids they recruit, but also the expectations there.
Well, speaking of the coaching staff, I'm very curious to see how that offense will come together. I mean, Willie Taggart, he, like you said, he is very much of the Harbaugh tree. I mean, he will flat out tell you that everything he learned about how to run a program came from the Harbaughs. But the offense he's running is not remotely what Jim Harbaugh is running at Michigan. It is a modern, up-tempo, attack you, fast offense that he has. At USF, he coined it the Gulf Coast offense. And I asked him what he's going to call it now up in the Northwest, and he said, still the Gulf Coast offense. So that is definitely what they're going to run. That is what he expects the staff to run. But he also has the input now of Mario Cristobal, one of his co-OC, coming from Saban and Alabama and the system they run there. Marcus Arroyo, who I remember as the San Jose State quarterback, he spent the past 2 years at Oklahoma State where they were Gundy with, you know, Mason Rudolph and James Washington were, you know, beating people with the deep ball as well as anybody. So this all comes together. And I think that's important because Oregon fans are used to scoring a lot of points. They want to win games, obviously. They're going to want to see them score some points. And I think given his track record, I think they'll be able to do that.
Yeah. Marcus Arroyo, by the way, his name came up on a bunch of different coach search where different schools were interested in him and trying to, you know, hire him away. And so that was another good hire. I'm very curious to see how as his career kind of continues to go up from there.
Hey, I mentioned Gundy's name real quick there. Just a quick thing here.
Is this a rattlesnake thing or what?
No,
did you do now?
I know. Well, here's what he did. They got their rings.
I did see this. The 11-2.
And their rings for this past season say 11-2, not 10-3. Because he considers the Central Michigan game a win. How do we feel about this?
Let him do what he wants to do. I mean, ultimately, no one, you know, the only people who are going to look at those rings are the people, you know, years from now. I mean, does 10-3 look that much worse than 11-2 or vice versa?
No. And you didn't go 11-2. You went 10-3.
Right, but I'm saying, like, if this was a case of, let's say, you know, there's been teams who, like, you know, had a bad call and kept them from being undefeated, that's a different story. Or if you want to say, you know, you're on Urban Meyer's team where it went undefeated, but, you know, because of the sanctions, they were kept out, different story. But you lost a couple of games anyway. I mean, I was at the game in the rain where, you know, Oklahoma took it to them pretty good. It's like, I don't know.
I don't think it's as egregious as like when Texas A&M, finished in a three-way tie for first in the Big 12 South, but didn't go to the championship game, and they still gave them rings or banner. I don't remember a banner maybe that said Big 12 South champs. That's not this, but that's kind of Gundy, right? Like, I remember he said it during the season last year when he would, as it was going, you know, oh, we're an 8-2 team. No, you're not.
I'm not going to hold it against him. I just think it's kind of, to me, it did seem a little bit silly, but to each his own.
I want to bring up a interest. The NFL draft is next week, and you know how I feel about the NFL draft process, and this to me is a great example of it. It is now, look, ESPN, everybody, you know, the talking heads, they have to talk about this for 4 months. They got to keep coming up with new storylines. And this morning I saw that one of the new storylines on ESPN is whether Josh Dobbs from Tennessee can sneak into the late first round. Now, Josh Dobbs is a great kid, as you know. Very smart, just like put up
conscientious, does great work off the field.
Put up with so much
crap
there. So
please, Stu, please, Stu. I feel like this is the cartoon where the huge like piano is about to come down on Josh Dobbs' head and you're going to drop it.
Josh Dobbs is not even remotely a first-round quarterback. And it surprises me because normally these NFL guys frown on the dual-threat quarterbacks who aren't as advanced as a passer as they are a runner. And that's basically who he is. I mean, he kept them in games with his running ability. But I think you could maybe count on a couple of fingers the numbers of games that Tennessee won because he had such a great passing day.
How surprised would you be if Josh Dobbs was actually a starting quarterback in the NFL within the next 5 years?
Starting wouldn't shock me because a lot of guys become starting quarterbacks, right? I mean, nothing will ever surprise me more than Trevor Siemian becoming an NFL starting quarterback. Starting, fine. But late first round, if that were to happen, means you think he could be an all-pro at some point, and that's not going to happen.
Why are you so down on him?
Because I watched him play football.
His numbers actually are not bad. Almost threw for 3,000 yards, 27 touchdowns, 12 picks. Also ran for over 800 yards and 12 more touchdowns. This was interesting to me. I got to admit, I was a little surprised by, you know, I wouldn't have thought Josh Dobbs would have gone in the first three rounds, because I didn't, you know, the consistency as a passer.
And he still might not, by the way. This may just be them manufacturing a storyline.
Well, the first time it caught my eye was a few days ago. I saw on Twitter, I think it was from the Feinbaum show. I didn't actually hear it, but I saw that the Feinbaum account tweeted this out. Louis Riddick, who works for ESPN and is a former player, but also a former front office guy, I have a ton of respect for him, for his insight and everything. I think he's a great follow on Twitter. And I'll be honest, he knows way more about the NFL than I do. He did say this: I don't see why Josh Dobbs couldn't have the same effect on a football team as Dak Prescott had. Now, obviously, that's a little bit vague in terms of that. I mean, you know, Dak Prescott was a revelation for the Cowboys. He played behind a great offensive line, but was a terrific rookie find for them, you know, not in the first round. Had a ton of success at Mississippi State, the best player they probably ever had in that program's history. And I think there were concerns about Dak Prescott, not only the system he came out of, but also I think there were some concerns about him as a passer.
Dak Prescott, look, I would not, you know, say, you know, there's no way I could possibly say or take credit for having seen anything like this coming with Dak Prescott. But he did lead a program that has been, you know, had very little national prominence to the number one ranking in the country at one point. He was that dynamic a leader and a quarterback. And he did it, by the way, with guys who were not nearly as heavily recruited as the guys Josh Dobbs is playing with. I'm looking at his game log from last year. And by the way, there is one that just I had to do a double take. Did this really happen? Remember they lost to Vanderbilt in kind of a high-scoring game? Did you know he was 31 of 34 for 340 yards that day?
Yeah, that sounds
pretty good. But Alabama, you know, the NFL defense of the SEC, if you will, 16 of 27 for 92 yards. No touchdowns and a pick. Let's see. If you had to pick out what his best game was, I guess you'd probably say that Florida game where they came back from a big deficit.
Yeah.
16 of 32 for 319, four touchdowns and two picks, and ran 17 times for 80 yards. I think that will always be the high point of his time.
I'm going to read you this, and it's good in retrospect. And this is from NFL.com. It's their scouting report on. They have experts for this thing. The weaknesses on Dak Prescott: increase in short pass attempts from 86 to 208 attempts this year. That was the year you're talking about, 2015.
No. The 2014, he is when he led them to the number one ranking. He came back.
I think this is saying in 2015 they had twice as many short pass attempts as they did the year before. And accuracy, and that was why they thought his completion numbers went up. Accuracy on intermediate and deep throws drops sharply. Pocket poise has been compromised. Hyper aware of pressure around him and lacks awareness to slide and find temporary shelter to make throw. Concern over pressure too often trumps ability to get through progressions. Must speed up pace of reads, and footwork is a mess. One thing I will say, then there's some other. You know, issues, needs to improve anticipation. He went to a great place because the Dallas Cowboys have as good an offensive line as anybody in the NFL, but obviously he delivered under those circumstances. It is, as I've said many times, it is a big, big crapshoot.
Here's what I think happens. They have these teams invest so much money in the scouting process. You know, by the time you get to the draft, they've seen these guys. I mean, in many cases, they've gone to the schools and seen them in practice. They've seen them in games. They've seen them at the combine, pro day, the Senior Bowl. They've watched a gazillion hours of tape. And I think if you give them that long to do that, they can talk themselves in and out of just about anything. It would be an interesting psychological study, to be honest, in how, like, Like, let's say on January 10th, you're totally convinced. You've watched Deshaun Watson for 3 years, and you're totally convinced he's the best quarterback in the draft. But you still have to do something with your time for the next 3 months. So you start watching the tape again and again, and now you're starting to see, well, wait a minute. Now I'm not as sure about his accuracy on the deep. You know what I mean? Like, I'll tell you what, if you gave him another 4 months, they might start finding walk-ons on these teams and saying, ah, this guy's going to be the next Dak Prescott.
Yeah, I don't doubt what you're saying. I think there's also, it's beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You could probably find some scout to rave about a guy and some. And I go back to this. My last night at the Combine this year, I had a beer at one point with an NFL quarterback coach who did not think Pat Mahomes would be an NFL quarterback, could be an NFL quarterback, and just thought he was so raw and, you know, didn't do anything from the pocket. Everything was unconventional, and said you can't play in the NFL like that. And Pat Mahomes, if if you're looking on social media, and I'm talking about just a lot of places, it sounds like Pat Mahomes may end up as a first round pick.
Well, so by any chance, have you followed up with him about that?
I have not. I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, because I would be curious to know what he thinks now, because look, and this is not unique to the draft by any, in any industry, in our industry, we're all susceptible to groupthink. We're all susceptible to, we don't want to be wrong, right? So if everybody else is starting to think something and you're not, then you start to question yourself. I would be curious if he's changed his opinion on that in the wake of whether or not, in the wake of like all of his colleagues pushing this.
Well, I don't know if all of his colleagues are pushing it. It could be a few. I mean, one thing I did hear when I was there was he is like a bigger Johnny Manziel without the baggage. Well, if you have Johnny Manziel without the baggage and bigger, I think that would tempt a lot of people, you know, in terms of that. He certainly didn't have the talent around him that Manziel had on the offensive line, or he didn't have a Mike Evans. Not having the baggage is a huge piece of Johnny Manziel's, you know, NFL demise, at least at this point. So,
I'm just glad they don't draft sports writers. Can you imagine if like everybody was analyzed in this way?
Schroeder can't file on time.
So I'm saying like the next, like some 22-year-old is graduating from Missouri Journalism School and they're scouting him and they're like, he's like, Dennis Dodd, but without the great lead. You know what I mean? Like everybody would be compared to somebody else.
This has the potential to go off the rails in a hurry if we start calling out some of our buddies.
He's like Bruce Feldman, except he doesn't have encyclopedic recall of heights and weights.
That seems to really stuck with you for some reason, huh?
Well, it just really impresses me because I can't remember any of them.
Getting back to your point about give them enough time and they'll, you know, find everything. I have a prediction that at some point, if in fact Sam Darnold has a really good sophomore year and then were to leave, I think you would hear a lot about people talking about his you know, wind up and his mechanics and people starting to like nitpick on that we probably hadn't heard much of. Like the idea that somebody is too good to be true, you know, won't happen. It certainly won't happen with a quarterback. It certainly will not happen. If that player is too good to be true athletically, I mean, look, they're picking Myles Garrett apart because even though he had double teams and, you know, wasn't healthy at times in the SEC and still played, they didn't love his SEC production.
Who was the last quarterback that everybody was 100% on board, like, this guy's going to be a star?
My thing on the closest thing to can't miss that has happened in the last decade was Andrew Luck.
That's what I remember.
People didn't think he had a cannon for an arm.
Well, it also became a debate where some people thought you should take RG3 number one.
Yeah, you remember, though, RG3 had a terrific rookie year. I think it depends on what you run and what you do, system-wise, how a guy
fits. I mean, I voted for him over Andrew Luck for the Heisman that year, so it's not like I'm saying he was a bad player by any means. I thought he was great. But in terms of a pro quarter, I thought Andrew Luck, you know, going into that last year, it seemed like it was they thought he'd be the number one pick in August, and he was the number one pick. How often does that happen anymore? It's not like people jumped off his bandwagon, but I don't think it was necessarily – people still found stuff to debate there. Who was it, Phil Simms, that said he had a weak arm?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, Joe Montana didn't have as big an arm as him and obviously turned out great. There's been plenty of quarterbacks who had average arms who thrived in the NFL. So
one day it'll be the unicorn. It'll be the quarterback that 100%. Well, you know what? It won't happen because even if that were true, you've still got to have something to debate on these sports debate shows. So somebody would find something wrong with them and prop up somebody else just for the show.
I think you're right. There has to be something. There has to be something. I mean, I was, you know, wowed by my, you know, hearing all this stuff and being around Saquon Barkley. But ultimately, you know, let's say he has a big junior year and he leaves. There are going to be people who go, are you really going to spend a top five pick on a running back? There's less value on the running back. So if it's not the player, it becomes the position or the fit they have, or, you know, they've had too many carries. I mean, there'll be something for people to always find fault with.
That, by the way, has been an interesting trend, how just only a few years ago it was, well, you know, and if running backs are never going to go high anymore because they're expendable and they have a short shelf life. And now, like, within 3 years, we've gone to Ezekiel Elliott. You know, he showed it's worth it. So all these running backs are going to go high this year, and Barkley's going to go even higher next year. We'll see. How about we get to the mailbag?
Okay. Hit it, Rob Stone.
It's the mailbag from a computer, so not literally a bag, but just mail.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And this is a fun one right off the bat. And Bruce, I was in Vegas a few weeks ago for March Madness, and while I was there, I laid down a few college football futures bets. I found some of the odds surprising, like Penn State at 25-1 to win the national championship. The Big Ten champs with a lot of returning starters at 25-1 when Oklahoma is 12-1 seems wrong to me. And then he has included a PDF of the sheet. So, give me your thoughts on Penn State. You were just there, whether that 25-1 seems like a good bet to you. And then I'm going to read to you some of the other ones.
I don't think they should be much higher than that, because I think they have as good a firepower on offense as anybody will in the country, and a great system with Joe Moorhead's offense. But personnel-wise in that front seven, they don't have the caliber athletes that Ohio State has. I would say really roster-wise, they're probably about 2 years away from, you know, I see them being on that level if they keep trending up. But they don't have that. And so here's my issue and why I think they are 25-1. I'm going to read you this, and I remember thinking this a few days ago. So when the calendar starts getting – when the leaves change and we get deep into October, they host Michigan, then they go to Columbus, and then they play at Michigan State. That's not going to be an easy stretch. You know, that back-to-back where, you know, they could afford to lose one of those. But that's a heavy group that they have. By the way, and before that, they have to play at Northwestern. I think they have a bye week in there. They also have to go to Iowa. So
you're okay with 25-1. I mean,
I am, because they're in the toughest division in college football, and they're in a much tougher conference than Oklahoma's in.
So I'm going to start reading some of these to you, and you can just tell me, stop me if I get to
buy or sell. Yeah.
Oh, you want to do buy or sell? Yeah, we can do buy or sell. Okay, Alabama 3-1.
That's where it should be. Yeah.
Ohio State 15-2.
Yeah, I like that. I would buy that.
USC 6-1.
I'm not as bullish on them as Coward is. But I would say probably if you told me they were 8-1, I'd say okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
I don't think they're as good on defense as they probably need to be up there.
I think based on our conversation the other day, you're going to want to sell this one. Florida State is the same as Ohio State, 15-2.
No, I like DeAndre Francois. I think Cam Akers is a real deal. I'm on that. I think they'll be the ACC champs.
Okay, sell for me. Oklahoma 12-1.
Yeah, I'm not loving Mike Stoops' defense, but the offensive line now has a lot of experience, and I think Baker Mayfield is terrific. So, you know, if they were 9-1, I would see it. So,
if you're an Oklahoma believer that they could win the national championship, you're basically saying you're putting all your eggs on Baker Mayfield, right? Because you no longer have Mixon and P. Ryan.
D.D. Westbrook was a really good receiver, you know, productive. So
on. They do have some experienced guys on defense, but I don't think it's going to be a dominant defense. So, you know, I mean, as of our last conversation, we were about the Big 12. We weren't sure whether we were even just sure that they were going to be our Big 12 favorites, whether it's going to be them, Oklahoma State, or West Virginia. Clemson, the defending national champs, 20-1. This may surprise you, but LSU has better odds at 18-1.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have LSU with better odds. I would say you could reverse them because they're pretty, you know, to me, the one thing is they, you know, Deshaun Watson, I won't say it was everything because they had a lot of really good talent around them, but I think that's a step back. So I would say Clemson 15-1, LSU 20-1. How's that?
Michigan, which opened at 15-1, is now 12-1, despite having to replace 18 starters.
Because I think people looked and so, yeah, they have that many guys to replace. But the guys on the D-line, their D-line still may be one of the best D-lines in the country.
And some of this is also just they're a big name and Michigan fans have a huge –
sure.
You know, they're going to bet.
By the way, I want to go back to what I just said when I said LSU should be, you know, instead of 20-1, maybe 25-1, just where Penn State is.
I think Penn State should be higher than LSU.
Yeah, and maybe so. Maybe so. I mean, I just think Penn State is in a tougher division than LSU is right now.
How about this one? Lamar Jackson and the Louisville Cardinals checking in at 20-1. I don't think they can win the national championship.
I don't think they can either. Do you see Lamar Jackson making it to New York this year for the Heisman?
That is a great question. And while it is always hard for the winner to repeat, I feel like this is the hardest one yet. Because of the way he finished last season, and a lot of people think he shouldn't have won it anyway. Sam Darnold already has better odds to start the season. I'll go ahead and say that provided he stays healthy, I do think he'll make it there. Because when he's playing well, he's still, you know, he's dazzling. His highlights are amazing. And I don't think he's going to go from people thinking he was the best player in the country to not one of the three or four best if he is healthy the whole season.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens there. Just, you know, this would be a good example of what Bobby Petrino can do and how much better they can, you know, he can get.
All right, I'm buying both of these next two. Washington 25-1 and Oklahoma State 40-1.
Yeah, I'm surprised Washington is so low there.
Yeah, why is Washington, a playoff team from last year, 25-1 and the same as Penn State, and Michigan is 12-1.
The only thing I can think of is because they lost, you know, three really good guys in the secondary. And, you know, I mean, they still have, you know, yeah, they lost John Ross, but they still have some firepower. They have a really good running back. You know, Austin Pettis is a really good receiver. So
just a couple more here. Florida is 50-1. If you think Jim McElwain is on the poise on the brink of a huge breakthrough, then.
I think I said Austin Pettis. Dante Pettis.
Yeah.
That's
all right.
A little bit of a prank.
It's all right. All right, and here's one where, again, I said, you know, brand name matters here. Texas, 25-1. Same as Penn State, same as Washington.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing that. I think they, if you told me 50-1, where's Notre Dame?
Well, that's the weird thing. Texas opened at 50-1 and is now 25-1. A lot of Tom Herman believers in putting their money down at Vegas. Notre Dame opened at 75-1 and is now 50-1.
Yeah.
Stanford is 100-1.
You know, I listened to our podcast the other day, and you were pretty much raving about Stanford, and I'm still not sure exactly why, other than we both think David Shaw is a terrific coach.
Well, I think they're going to be – you're talking about the one where I – was at the scrimmage?
Yeah, you came away really gushing about their defense.
Their defense is really good. There's no question about that, but they have a lot of – quite, you know, it's when we talked about with Andy, is everything going to come together in offense where Keller Chris comes back, and he's 100% by August – and they find some new playmaking receivers, and the offensive line could protect Chris. I mean, there's a lot of questions there.
Okay. I mean, I'm not as, like, I feel like you're saying Stanford is going to be, no, you're not calling them, like, the 85 Bears, but, you know, they didn't have a top 30 defense last year with Solomon Thomas.
But they're much more experienced this year. They'll win 10 games.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
Whether that's going to be enough to win the division, I don't know, but they'll win 10 games.
Okay. This question is from Rob Daniels. Gentlemen, with the December signing period, if implemented, yes, results in fewer coach firings, A, and B, have no impact on the numbers of firings, but change the dismissal timing. In other words, will coaches be fired in October and November in greater numbers than in the past? Curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think the coaches that would have been fired before are still going to get fired, but I do think there's now going to be a tremendous amount of pressure to fire your coach and have the new coach in place by the time that December signing day comes. So does that mean more coaches get fired in the middle of the season? Does it mean that more people are going to kind of go the various backdoor channels you need to go to have conversations with the coaches that you're interested in while they're still in their seasons? I don't know. But, you know, I do think that becomes a big factor.
I don't think it's going to be a case of people are going to be making those decisions because of that. Also, I'm a little skeptical of how many schools would try to get that hire done, rush it through, just because the reality is if you fire a coach and then you try to hire somebody else, chances are the kids who might be interested in that school then, they're not going to rush into the decision because they probably don't know that much about that coach you're hiring.
What will be interesting to see is if they treat it like...
Let me give you an example. So earlier this week, or as we're taping today, Boston College announced its new AD, Martin Jarmon, Gene Smith guy, came from Ohio State. It's not a stretch to think that they may fire Steve Adazio at BC. So let's say they did that, and then he decides, you know what, I'm going to hire, you know, Ohio State's having a good year, I'm going to hire Ryan Day, who had worked at BC, he's a Northeast guy, Chip Kelly disciple, and he's a quarterback coach at Ohio State. Do we really think, you know, let's say that happens, you know, they fire Adazio, get rid of him on Thanksgiving, and then make this move within 10 days. Do we really think some kid is going to be turn around and go, okay, you know, we got to hire this guy right away just because we're going to force this hire through? To me, it doesn't sound like that doesn't seem that practical.
I think in general, there's going to be tremendous pressure on kids to sign at the early signing period. I don't think it's going to be like, if you're sure, sign. If not, wait till February. I think it's going to be sign now or we might give your spot away, unless you're, you know, five-star Rashawn Gary type. So in the case of a school like that, you know, I think what would happen is they would hire the guy and he would immediately get on a plane and try to visit as many of their committed recruits as possible in a short amount of time. In justifying this and in terms of the issue of coaches getting fired, I know that the people that supported this, like Bob Bowlesby, said that, you know, they did the study and they found that a overwhelmingly high percentage of guys who were committed before a coach got fired still ended up signing with that school. And so if that's going to be the case going forward, then I guess you could do this one of two ways. One would be, you know, and this is, I'm saying if the coaching change happens really close to the signing day, too close to do what you're talking about. Remember how much crap Jim Grobe took when he got to Baylor and he wouldn't let the kids out of the letter of intent?
I do remember that, yes. We'll have to see how this plays out.
It's fascinating. I don't know how it's going to play out. You know, I have my own hunch that it's going to be, it's going to replace February as signing day, but we shall see. This is from Don Hartman in Landon, Pennsylvania. Bruce, on the episode, he's talking about the episode where you recapped your visit to State College. You didn't say anything about Penn State's offensive line. What was your impression of them? It seems to me that the offensive line could actually be a strength this season after a few seasons of being the weakest link on the offense.
You know what? I want to say it was better than I expected it to be. Not to the level when you see the receivers. That was the thing that obviously I've been kind of gushing over. But it was better. I know that they have a couple of young linemen they really liked. I want to say Connor McGregor, but it's Connor McGovern who had come in there, played well. There's a younger, an early enrollee freshman that James Franklin talked to me about that he was pretty excited about, Mike Morandi. He said he's, you know, not that big, but just a really, really good football player. And so I think what you've seen now with the scholarship numbers getting up, they have really upgraded in terms of the not just the depth, but the kind of guys they have in there. And again, I don't think this is going to be, you know, because they had so many issues protecting Hackenberg a couple of years ago, because they had no depth. I think, you know, Lime Grover, he comes in from Minnesota, had a pretty strong reputation there, but he works very well with Joe Moorhead. I think they both even went to like the same elementary school. So I think when you have that guys on the same page, I think it gives them a really good base to build off of. So I think it's pretty good. I mean, you know, a long way. And they have, like I said, they have a lot of talent to work with.
When you go on these visits, do you feel like you understand offensive line play enough to actually evaluate offensive lines?
In the case of that, I'm not watching their offensive line too much. I'm basically eyeballing them. And in the case of that, it was like pre-practice stuff just to see physically who looks like, you know, like a Big Ten offensive line should look.
Yeah, because I feel like I have no there was a school I went to last year, and they wanted me to do a radio interview afterward, and they were basically like one by one, like how the quarterbacks look, how the running backs look. And they got the offensive line, and I said, I have no idea. I guess if you're watching like a live situation and the quarterback is constantly under pressure, that might be a bad sign for the offensive line, but it also might just mean they have a really good pass rush.
Or it could mean that, you know, especially when you're looking at it, so a lot of times teams don't have good second team lines, but I think what's telling here is that group at the end of the year, but now going forward, they're still really young. I mean, I think there's a chance they could start, you know, like a bunch of second year guys. And so, you know, you're in the deep end of the pool there. And I think that's still going to be a challenge. But, you know, going forward, because they are so good at what they do scheme wise, I think, and it gets teams on their heels defensively. And I think that helps the offensive line too. And you know, so I think that's why they're very excited about what they got there.
Let me ask you this next one as well from John Rohrbach. Washington State loses Gabe Marks and River Craycraft next year, each of whom performed bigly last season and accounted for many, many beautiful yards. We always hear about system quarterbacks and occasionally about system receivers in the air raid type offenses. But his question is, how are offenses like Mike Leach able to plug and play with new wide receivers? And do you think Washington State will be able to keep pace with last year's offense in 2017? Before you answer that, I promised our friend Lindsey Schnell real quick that we would plug, you know, we had Andy on last week and he talked about, our last episode, he talked about their regular podcast, Campus Rush. But right now, Lindsey is doing this special one for the NFL draft season. And Gabe Marks is the featured subject of the current one.
Gabe Marks, very interesting dude. You know, he's a LA kid, obviously had a great run there. Was such a clutch receiver for them. I mean, physically, he's very average, you know, in terms of by NFL standards, but he was such a go-to guy for that offense. You know, the most talented receiver Leach has had, maybe since he's been there, is Tavares Martin. He's a Florida kid. He's got, you know, decent length. He can really run. He needs to take a big step forward. I mean, he could be the home run hitter they really haven't had. The other one who's a redshirt freshman, who's a big physical guy who runs pretty well, is Dez Patman. He's from San Diego. I think you'll see him be more of a weapon. As far as the I know they have a JC guy, and I'm blanking on his name. He's another, I want to say, City College San Francisco kid who is – they really like, and it's been very impressive. It's very, it's probably most similar to Marks in terms of good hands, probably a little quicker than Gabe Marks. We'll see if he has the same kind of toughness and competitiveness. But so I think those guys are guys you'll see step forward. In terms of the offense, I think it should be, even without Marks, it should be every bit as good. You have Luke Falk is there. They have four running backs who are really good. They're all back. And I think the offensive line should be very, very good. I mean, you look at Andre Dillard. He's an all Pac-12 kind of guy. Cody O'Connell, also back. I mean, they have a bunch of experience. And I think, you know, what gets back to John's question a little bit, how are they able to plug and play? So much of that system, more than probably any other system in college football, or at least as much as any other system, it is timing based and they rep it so much. And a lot of these guys, you know, it's very rare when somebody just jumps into it. Now this JC kid's a mid-year. He's one of those who's that way, but you know, it takes a while before they get it down. And that's why I think you saw Leach's team struggle so much when he got there at first. I mean, yeah, they were really bad on the offensive line, but I think it was just not, you know, not having a feel for it. And then eventually after a couple of years, they finally got the rhythm down. You want to move on to James Cunningham in Raleigh, North Carolina?
Yeah.
Okay. On the last podcast, Bruce made a comment in responding to another listener's email I found curious. since I haven't read this yet, I'm a little curious myself. Bruce's comment, I'm paraphrasing here, was if colleges can't keep up with spending on coaches and facilities, they shouldn't be in the game. Now I'm wondering what was meant by that. Do you think there'll be an inevitable split in the NCAA between the Power Five and the rest? Will we see another Division One and one AA? If the money being spent, doesn't that mean that half of college football will go away with all these rules?
So that's not, I mean, you tell me, but that's not what I took your comment to mean. I think you were just saying, and I think a lot of people in the NCAA agree now, or certainly stop trying to create equality. The equality doesn't exist in the first place. If you can spend the money on a 10th assistant or a $10,000 locker, good for you. If you don't, then, you know, you'll still be able to play football. Life goes on. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, and I do think, you know, towards James's question, what I see happening, and I would bet you'd agree, is the gap between the haves and the have-nots will only continue to grow. I do love the idea that, you know, the Sun Belt and the MAC are part of, quote, major college football. You know, I feel like I hear the term mid-major as more of a college basketball term than college football, even though, you know, obviously in the tournament you have a better chance, I feel like, of having these big branded upsets. But I think going forward towards James's question, do you see maybe 10 years from now that we will get this kind of breaking apart of the Power Fives from everybody else?
I do, and I don't know what form that will take. But, I mean, they're already...
Nick Saban taught, like, kind of hints around that.
I think they're already kind of not playing the same sport. You know, like, you've got on the high end, you've got Alabama, 100,000 people in the stadium every week. You know, the SEC is giving them $30, $40 million a year in distribution. And then on the low end of that, you've got, like, you know, 4,000 people in a stadium at a MAC game, and they're fortunate to get a $200,000 check for the TV. I mean, how long can that continue? I don't know. But of course, I've also theorized it could be more drastic than that, that eventually the Ohio States and Michigans will say, why are we letting Purdue dictate how much TV value we get? So that's far off down the future. In the meantime, I did a story last week about NIU. They have this ridiculous schedule in 28. They just added a road game at Florida State in 2018 to go with already playing at Iowa, at BYU, and Utah at home. I mean, it's just the most ambitious non-conference schedule I've ever seen. Unfortunately for them, that's partly out of necessity. They canceled a home game against Idaho to go play this road game at Florida State because it's a $1.6 million guarantee. And they need it because the state of Illinois budget has been frozen for 2 years. So they're desperate. And the AD flat out said, you know, this, thank God for Florida State, this paycheck is basically going to save a lot of people's jobs. Like, if they hadn't gotten this infusion of money, they would have had to lay off a bunch of athletic department staff. And I use a good program. I mean, they played in the Orange Bowl a few years ago. So, like, something's got to give, right? How are they going to continue to operate in the quote-unquote same level as the schools that bring in $40 million a year in TV revenue?
These are issues that you're never going to resolve. I mean, it's like, this is kind of a society we live in that's not built for this, right? It's not built.
Whoa, you're going deep on me now.
No, but I'm just saying, like, why do we look at NCAA athletics through a different prism that we look at everything else in our lives?
You mean in terms of, like, they're just naturally being rich people and poor people?
Yeah, I mean, I mean that's probably making it more blunt than I would mean it, but there, along those same lines, I always come back to this, whereas the Stanford education carries a lot more weight in the world than some other school in a different part of the country.
And that same NIU AD, Sean Frazier, is the one who you may remember a couple months ago, I believe it was Dennis Dodd's story at CBS, who is pushing for the idea of the group of five forming their own playoff. And it has so far been met with, like, not a lot of interest from the other conferences, but I talked to him about that as well, and he wanted to emphasize that that was not about, like, we want to take our ball and go home and play for something else. It was literally, like, we need the money, and we think that something like this might fetch more money than we're getting right now. I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks they should do something like that, that they should just kind of admit, we're not going to get to go to the playoff, we're not really we're never going to fetch the eyeballs that, that these big name schools are going to. So why don't we form our own product? And maybe that happens before, like, the split would, you know, everybody assumes the split would come because the Power Five schools would split off, but they don't really have any need to. And the system works fine for them the way it is. It's the smaller schools that might need to find another way. And so far it doesn't seem to involve dropping down to FCS. We, you know, that's going to happen with Idaho here next year. But other than that, I mean, they're the first school ever to do that, to drop down from what used to be 1A to 1AA and now is FBS to FCS. Otherwise, it's going the opposite direction. More FCS schools keep wanting to join FBS, even though you see what a financial strain that can be.
Yeah, I mean, that's, it's a calculated investment by a lot of places.
This last one, I like when the readers bring something to my attention that I wasn't aware of. And maybe you were, but I certainly was not. This is from Adam in Washington, D.C., who is a Central Michigan fan, apparently. Stuart and Bruce, listening to... Oh, and by the way, if he's a Central Michigan fan, we know how he feels about the Gundy thing. Get over it, you lost. Listening to the last episode... It does, his signature says, P.S. Mike Gundy, get over it, you lost. Listening to the last episode, oddly enough, on a United flight, and your conversation about former players and coaches got me thinking, why would someone with the NFL experience of Shane Graham go be a quality control coach at a place like Central Michigan? While I'm a former Chippewa, it seems perplexing someone of his stature wouldn't be at his alma mater or at least a Power 5 school. Bruce, did you realize that Shane Graham is now the special teams quality control coach at Central Michigan?
I didn't, but my guess is, and I know John Bonamigo, the head coach there reasonably well, is a longtime NFL special teams guy. And I have just Wikipedia'd Shane Graham's career, and I've never seen this. So, I'm going to read to you, and this is Wikipedia, so maybe it's not all accurate, but career history. In 2000, he was with the Richmond Speed, the New Orleans Saints. In 2001, he was with the Seahawks, the Bills. 2002, Seahawks again, Panthers, Bengals, Ravens, Giants, Patriots, Redskins, Cowboys, Dolphins, Ravens, Texans, Browns, Steelers. 2013 to 2015, back with the Saints. And in 2015, also with the Falcons.
I did not realize that. I associate him with the Bengals. And as I look at it now, that may be the only team he spent. He spent seven seasons with the Bengals, and that appears to be the only time he was with anybody for more than a year, up until the Saints toward the end. That's amazing. He played for almost the entire NFL. So what you're saying is he must have crossed paths with John Bonamigo.
And Bonamigo has been at a lot of places, too. And I got to know him a little bit first when he was with the Dolphins.
Keep talking, and I'll cross-reference it.
Well, it's not going to be that easy, because here's Bonamigo's list once he got into NFL, because he'd been a college's guy in the 90s in the Northeast. Jacksonville Jaguars, Green Bay Packers, New Orleans Saints,
Miami Dolphins. Yeah, I'm waiting for it to match up.
New Orleans Saints, Jacksonville Jaguars, Detroit Lions.
It would have been so much easier if it was the Bengals. Even the Dolphins, they just barely missed overlapping.
I think it's the Saints. It has to be the Saints. Wait. He was with Saints 2013 to 2015. That wouldn't work then, would it?
There's no point here where they overlapped, but surely they must know each other, and that's how this came to be. Look, you got to start somewhere. If Shane Graham wants to get into college coaching, you got to start somewhere.
Rather than do all this, I think it'd be easier if I just text him. How do you know Shane Graham? Did you know Shane Graham?
Do it right now. You got to start somewhere. And apparently, you know, the Power Five schools were filled, or I don't know if you tried that way or not. Honestly, the most surprising thing to me of all of this is that a school like Central Michigan, after we just got done talking about the difference in resources, has a special teams quality control assistant on its staff.
Well, it's a good thing first of all, when you have a head coach who, that's his background, you're going to think he's going to put an added emphasis on it. So I think that's probably part of it.
That's a good point. How many schools, even at the Power 5 level, have one of those off-field positions devoted to special teams?
I think more than you'd think. I want to say LSU had a couple of guys doing that. Did you ever coach Shane Graham before? No. So let me see what else.
You're getting to see Bruce Feldman in action here. I mean, you got that text back immediately.
Yeah.
Just say, we are answering a question about this on the Audible, and we are perplexed why he was working with you.
Worked him out when he was coming out of Virginia Tech, stayed in touch with him.
Holy cow, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
He can't. He was on the team that went to the national title game, right?
NFL fraternity is small.
Yeah, he went undrafted out of Virginia Tech in 2000. So yes, his last year in 99, that was the year they went to the national title game. So he worked him out going into the 2000 draft when John Bonamigo was with the Saints. And no, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong page. When he was with the Jaguars, and they stayed in touch ever since. Wow. I can see the I can't see you right now, but I think the wheels are spinning and that this is going to be a story here in the next couple of days.
No. I don't think so, but
so, look, we try to give you inside knowledge here on the Audible, and I don't think you could get any more inside than that. And I'm sure that that Adam in Washington D.C., Adam Lewis in Washington D.C. is never guessed when he sent you that podcast that he would get or that question that he would get a real-time answer.
Who is your favorite Central Michigan player of all time, Stu? I bet you I know who it's going to be.
Central Michigan player of all time. It's everybody's Dan LeFever.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to.
You're going to give me a less obvious one?
Well, you know what's kind of interesting about them is, so did LeFever ever finish in the top 10 for the Heisman?
He did. I mean, I'll have to check that, but I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah.
With all that, it's funny because arguably the best receiver in the NFL is a Central Michigan guy, and neither one of us probably knew much of anything about him when he was there.
Was that Antonio Brown?
Yeah.
Now, was he there with LeFever?
I think so, because he's been in the NFL for about 7 or 8 years. LeFever was like the mid
2006 to 2009.
That would have been his receiver for a bunch of it. Yeah.
Okay. I guess we were so consumed with LeFever, we didn't pay attention to who he was throwing it to. I don't see any mention of him having finished in the Heisman top 10. I know there was definitely at least one year where there was like a bit of a grassroots campaign for him. And who was his coach?
Butch Jones and Brian Kelly.
I believe just Butch Jones. Yeah. Yeah, that would have been Butch Jones.
Brian Kelly would have been at Cincinnati. Cincinnati by then.
Yeah. Yeah, because LeFever's last year was 09, and that was the big Marty Gilliard, Cincinnati, Tony Pike, undefeated
right.
team. Yeah.
Plays Florida or whatever. See, this stuff is like kind of comfort food. We like our like Mac, you know, kind of stuff that you. I feel like you kind of fall in love with these programs a little bit when you don't see them on Saturdays because you have all the other stuff going on.
Well, I always have a soft spot for the Mac because of the part of the country that I'm from, and also, I mean, I remember when, you know, make fun of it now if you want, but I mean. When Randy Moss was at Marshall and Travis Prentice was at Miami, or even, you know, go a little bit forward from that to Leftwich at Marshall, like Gradkowski at Toledo, Roethlisberger at Miami, those were some good teams, you know? Like they weren't, you were watching Mac games then.
I mean, look, a lot of these guys end up showing up in the NFL, but I think it's entertaining football.
Yeah. And you're going to be seeing a lot of it on weeknights this year because they're not playing a single Saturday game in November.
And I'm okay with that.
Before we came on, you said you and I were going to try to keep this short. We are well over an hour at this point. Hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Again, theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And if you love the Audible, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Leave us a review, a 5-star review. It helps get the word out. We'll see you next time.